Once, quite a few years ago now, a young man came to see us with a view to joining the full-time community. The teacher interviewed him, and in the course of the interview, the prospective student said that he'd been to see many, many teachers and had gone to many, many centres all round the world, it seemed. Pressed a little further, he then started to talk about his own situation. He firmly believed that something very special was happening to him, something very mystical, something life-changing that would be for the betterment just not just of him, but for the world in general. The teacher asked him what he knew and understood about the Buddha's teaching. The young man replied that he didn't know anything about the Buddha's teaching, except you have to kill the Buddha. Before you kill him, replied the teacher, wouldn't it be a good idea to find out what he has to say first? Everyone in their own way is seeking the ending of suffering. And there are many, many different ways that people try. The Buddha, when he talked about people who enter into the training, said that there are four types of people. There are those that do not know that they do not know. There are those that know that they do not know. There are those that do not know that they know. And of course, there are those that know that they know. The young man fell into the first category, the kind of person that doesn't know that he doesn't know. Everyone in their own way is seeking the ending of suffering, and there are many different ways of going about that. Everyone really, in a sense, is trying to find the end of suffering by being different than they are. And everyone, in a way, is trying to create a self-image, an identity that they can hang on to, that they'll cling on to, that will give them security and safety in the world. Consider how long human beings have been going and how many human beings there have been and how many human beings there are. Were you to gather them all together and ask them, I know it's not possible, but were you to gather them all together and ask them, where is yourself located? What are the general and particular characteristics of yourself? Would they be able to tell you? It seems unlikely. If somebody had found the self, surely they would have broadcast it and made it known. The problem is, there isn't a self. But all unenlightened people believe that there is. Believing that there is, but not being able to find it, there is a very strong inclination to clothe the mind with things that might belong to a self, were it to exist. Those things might be physical, so it's my house, my wife, my husband, my dog, or they might be mental. My philosophy, my views, my ideas, my hopes, my fears. In the absence of self, the mind clothes itself in these concepts in order to give itself what appears to be a solid and reliable identity. There are many assumptions that come along with that created identity. And when people come to this teaching, they bring those assumptions along with them. For instance, I taught a woman a few years ago who didn't want my instruction. Oh, that's okay. Because, she said, she implicitly entrusted her inner guide, so she didn't need a physical human teacher. She came with assumptions and wasn't prepared to let them go. She didn't know that she didn't know. Some develop a very strong attachment to an intellectual appreciation of this teaching. They're able to gloss their experiences in terms of the teaching, and it very much sounds as if they know that they have some great knowledge, but all they actually have is an intellectual understanding. They don't have a direct experience. They do not know that they do not know. Some come to a teaching like this because they want something from it. They want to add something to their identity. A platform, perhaps. There was one chap who came along for an interview with a view to coming along to the group, who came with a manuscript that was that thick, that he had himself had written. The idea being that people here might very well be interested in what he had to say. What happens to people that do not know that they do not know when they try to put the practice in motion, when they actually try to put the practice together? If they begin to practice mindfulness, they begin to see aspects of themselves, that don't conform to the image that they've created for themselves. In such cases, you've either got two choices. You either cling mightily to your self-image, and therefore are at loggerheads with the teaching and the teachers. You resist the training. Or you let go of the self-image, just enough in order to be able to undertake the instruction and develop the practice. Dependent on how much clinging attachment there is to the self-image, the student will either leave or will let go. If they resist, their suffering increases. At what point does someone let go? At what point does someone become someone who knows that they do not know? It's quite a chasm to leap from believing you know to recognizing that you don't know. In a Dhamma talk, Alan was considering this very point and asked the students in the group to come up with ideas, which they duly did, as to how somebody bridges that gap. Eventually he said, but what about despair? And one monk said, I tried despair, and that didn't even work. When you reach the point that you realize that despair doesn't even work, what do you do? After all, everyone is trying to come to the cessation of suffering. There's a point that everyone reaches where they recognize that they need help in order to understand. And when I say understanding, I don't just mean intellectually understanding the teaching. I mean understanding how life really is, the reality of life. For some, it seems quite easy. They reach a point where they go, this meditation's just not going anywhere. I know, I'll go and see a teacher and ask them, what do I have to do to get this together? And they duly come along, and they're told, they're instructed in what they have to do, and they begin the meditation practice in earnest. For others, it can be extraordinarily traumatic, letting go of the self-image that I know, when in reality I do not. For such people, you do have to reach the end of your tether. But when somebody does make that leap, something tremendous happens. The true path to understanding opens up. Instead of self-defense, There's this wonderful letting go. When you accept that you don't know, suddenly faith, a genuine humility arises. Suddenly where what was closed off opens up. There's space. There's room to move. There's the ability suddenly to listen to the teacher, to listen to the teaching in a completely new and different way. There's a willingness to look at one's experience in terms of the teaching, rather than, as it were, taking bits of the teaching that the individual liked and forgetting about the rest. There is a recognition of the whole teaching and a desire to put the practice together in order to understand why it is that I suffer. So there's a tremendous relief, a letting go of that self-image, letting go of unnecessary burden. And it's at this point that the teaching really kicks in. Because rather than relying on that accumulated self-image, there suddenly becomes a desire to know, really, to really know how life works, using the teaching as a template. The student is ready at last to learn. And what we're instructed to do is to develop what the Buddha called the four foundations of mindfulness. I asked Alan in a Dhamma talk a question about how does a student develop the inner honesty that is required to bring this teaching to fulfillment, bring this practice to fulfillment. He very gently put me straight by saying, when I said inner honesty, what I actually meant was mindfulness. What do I mean by inner honesty? What I mean is that whatever arises in mind or body that is seen, noted as it really is, and let go of, that's mindfulness. It contains no bias, no I'll accept this and I won't accept that. It is a completely honest assessment of what is actually taking place in mind and body right now. That's what I mean by inner honesty, and that's what's meant by mindfulness. The two are exactly the same. Mindfulness equals inner honesty equals reality. If someone's willing to be absolutely honest about what's going on in their experience, they are learning. The investigation must be free of any hasty conclusions. One must put intellectual understanding to one side. With mindfulness, it is purely observing exactly what is there in its true nature. If someone investigates in the right way, without trying to get anything out of the practice, but just to know, just to understand, their energy is balanced. When the energy is balanced, what arises is pleasurable interest. Piti in the Pali. What that means is that there is this zest, this enjoyment of what's actually taking place, the actual observation, the investigation. And the student finds that if they practice in this way, that they become happy to learn. They are very happy to observe what's going on in mind and body, regardless of what it is that they find. What I'd like to do is to spend a couple of minutes of explaining mindfulness of feeling. Mindfulness of feeling is pivotal in coming to understand how suffering arises. How do you do it? It's very simple. All feeling arises conditioned by some sensory contact. It might be a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or some kind of mental object. Always arising on those objects, feeling arises. There are only three kinds of feeling when you come down to it. There are pleasant feelings, there are painful feelings, and there are neutral feelings. Whenever there is a contact, there is a subsequent feeling. If you become aware of the sensory contact, you immediately become aware of the feeling that follows it. Arising on feeling is some kind of response. If it is a pleasant feeling, the response is usually a greedy attachment to that pleasant feeling. If it's a painful feeling, there is usually an aversion and wanting to get rid of. If it's a neutral feeling, there is a tendency towards ignorance, ignoring. Why is this important? The teaching tells us that craving is the real cause of suffering, wanting life to be different than it is. Wanting life to be different than it is the response to the feeling. If it's a pleasant feeling, we want that feeling to last, and we become very unhappy when the pleasant feeling disappears. When a painful feeling arises, we want to get rid of it, failing to recognize that a painful feeling's nature is to pass away. And with a neutral feeling, well, we're not even aware of neutral feelings. The number of times that students have asked me, I can see pleasant feelings, I can see painful feelings, but I can never see neutral feelings. Well, if it's neither pleasant nor painful, it's neutral. But why am I making so much of feeling in the context of tonight's talk? It's very simple. To learn, you have to experience painful feelings. You cannot become enlightened without fully accepting painful feelings. Painful feelings happen. They occur to everyone. Everyone experiences them. If your self-image tells you you're a certain kind of person, but your mindfulness practice shows you that you have qualities that are different to that, you will experience a painful feeling. You want to get rid of the painful feeling, and you will try to get rid of it by either giving up the mindfulness practice or somehow subtly manipulating the teaching so that you don't have to look. That's why I'm making so much of mindfulness of feeling. Because if anyone understands feeling totally, if somebody sees the conditioned nature of feeling completely, and its transient nature completely, there is no need for any greedy attachment to pleasant feelings. There's no need for any aversion towards painful feelings, and there's no ignoring of neutral feelings. Seeing transience of feeling leads to non-clinging. What does mindfulness training give us? If we're willing to accept painful feelings, what mindfulness training will give us is the understanding of exactly what we do and don't do that creates our suffering. We will be able to recognize the actions that we perform that generate the results we experience. If we're willing to accept painful feelings, we're willing to be mindful of whatever arises in mind and body. If we're not willing to accept painful feelings, we will resist, and as a consequence, we will suffer. Understanding transience of pain allows us the luxury of getting it wrong again and again and again. When we practice the precepts, we train in keeping the precepts. Training means that we get it wrong again and again and again. But if we're willing to accept the results of our actions and observe carefully the results of our actions, we're able to learn. Eventually, we'll put the pieces together. We'll make the connections between, say, some wrong speech at work and the subsequent painful feeling later on in the evening. Recognizing that the painful feeling is transient, we can let go of the painful feeling. We can let go of the clinging to whatever the wrong speech was about. in the course of the day. We can just relax, be with that painful feeling, with the full understanding that that painful feeling will peter out in its own good time. As the practice develops, we get deeply into Vipassana, insight practice. Again and again and again, we turn our mind to observing transience, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self in all phenomena. The more able we are to let go and just observe pleasant feelings passing, painful feelings passing, neutral feelings passing, the mind relaxes, it softens. You can enter into very delightful, calm, blissful states. And you can also have arising some very deep insights into the nature of existence. But a warning here. From time to time, it's possible to go from somebody who knows that they do not know and slip back into somebody who does not know that they do not know. An illustration for you. An insight into emptiness arises in the mind of a meditator. This is a little bit like, imagine you're having a shower and you step out of the shower and 20 people are standing in your bathroom looking at you. Some of them known to you, some of them not known to you. How would you react? Of course, you would dive for the very first thing you could find to cover up your embarrassment, be it a towel, a flannel, a pot plant, or whatever. Yeah? When the mind gains insight into emptiness, when it has an experience of emptiness, say, the mind is embarrassed by its own nakedness. It's seen that that self-image is false. Being embarrassed, what's it going to do? It's going to use the first thing it can find to clothe itself. And what's the first thing that the mind finds with which it can clothe itself? Well, of course, the experience of emptiness itself. Ah, that was my experience of emptiness. It is I that has seen emptiness. It is I that understands non-self. I'm spiritually developed. I should be teaching. I mean, I go on and on and on. You get the drift. When that happens, somebody can go from being someone who knows they do not know to somebody who does not know that they do not know. And that can be very dangerous for a meditator. All meditators have to be sure not to cling or grasp onto any experience, including insights themselves. The Buddha himself said in the Satipatthana Sutta, the monk's mindfulness is established precisely to the extent necessary just for knowledge, just for remembrance, and he fares along independently of and not grasping anything in the world. So perhaps you can see from what I'm saying is that there is a continuous letting go of the self-image that we produce, keeping on letting go of any acquisition that comes from our mindfulness practice, recognizing that any clinging or grasping onto any meditative experience will actually close us off temporarily from any further learning. Eventually, I'm jumping quite a long way here ahead, a meditator reaches the end of the Buddhist training. They come to a complete experiential knowledge and vision of the way things really are through their mindfulness practice. They see quite clearly that all conditioned phenomena are transient, that all conditioned phenomena is unsatisfactory, and that all phenomena whatsoever is non-self. And you could say of these people that they are those that do not know that they know. But how can this be if they've undertaken the whole course of the training? They've come to see existence as it really is. How could they be those that do not know that they know? Ask anyone who's in that situation or has been in that situation, and they will tell you that they feel like they've completely understood this teaching. And yet, if they're honest, they'll also tell you that they're not enlightened. Why? And what to do? There is one subtle self-image left, and it's the subtle self-image of, am I or am I not enlightened? And the student's job is to let go of that last delusion. Zen put it like this: if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. Which has always sounded too dramatic for me. I prefer what the Buddha himself said when he talked about the parable of the raft. To get from the hither side of the bank to the further side, from the this side of a torrential river to the other side of a torrential river, you build yourself a raft. Having got to the other side of the raft, do you carry the raft around with you? It seemed like madness. It's fulfilled its purpose. The last thing to do is to let it go. The last thing the meditator gives up in the pursuit of enlightenment, and the last self-image, is the pursuit of enlightenment itself. The teaching, the Dhamma, the Buddha, everything. So they genuinely become, they know that they do not know. They've done everything they can, there's nothing more they can do. And in exactly the same way as I mentioned earlier, upon giving up that last self-image, the mind becomes so peaceful, alert and attentive, completely free of wanting life to be different. There's this tremendous, wonderful space in which the true realization of enlightenment can occur. And then there is one entirely mystical, non-communicable understanding that arises in that empty mind that explains everything. And the meditator comes to be one who knows that they know. That understanding is entirely transcendental to ordinary worldly knowledge, including all the ultimates. And it's complete freedom. It's freedom from self-concern, which was the one thing that held up the meditator's journey all the way along. Freedom from self-concern is the freedom to learn. Once a Dhamma teacher was taught some yoga moves by one of his students. The yoga teacher was very impressed with the Dhamma teacher's ability to learn the moves. The teacher said something very important, I think. He said, "The sign of spiritual maturity is not that someone is an outstanding teacher. The sign of spiritual maturity is that he or she is an outstanding student." When you've completely let go of all self-concern, there is nothing but learning. The universe is infinite. Therefore, learning is infinite. And because it was the last lecture of the season, I thought I'd write write something out. You gently close the gate behind you and step out along the enchanting little track that winds round the crest of the hill. The path is lined on either side by a multitude of long grasses and wild flowers, and you walk beneath an archway made of the branches of an overhanging blackthorn tree. The mind is quiet and serene. The body feels light and relaxed. There are no problems, no riddles to be solved. Everything is as it should be. The world is very beautiful this morning. Last night's rain has cleared the air, and the whole scene appears crisp, clean, and in focus. Everything sparkles in the early morning light. You gaze out across to the forests on the other side of the valley. You notice the beautiful bright green colour that late spring growth has given to the leaves, and marvel at the play of dappled sunlight on the treetops. In the valley below, a train noisily passes by. You see a narrow boat lazily making its way along the canal, and joggers on the towpath chat to one another as they run. Such activities do not disturb the scene. Rather, they are all an integral part of it. All that motion enveloped in the tremendous peace and perfect stillness of reality. The track takes you down the hill towards the little stone bridge that crosses the canal. Blackbirds are singing sweetly in the hedgerow nearby. A jackdaw sitting on a telephone wire lets out its throaty call, flaps its wings, and smoothly takes to the air. The warmth of the sun touches the back of your neck, and from nowhere the most delicate sense of grace arises, filling every fibre of your being with love and fulfilment. And you simply cannot believe your luck, that by some mysterious force you have been carried from the depths of suffering to that freedom for which everyone seeks. You have understood, and you know that you know. And you know in a way that you just cannot possibly explain. But you are free. The task of this life has been completed, the burden put down. You are free from all attachment, free from all becoming, free from all delusion. You know now who, or rather what, you really are, and you are forever set free to explore the wondrous mysteries of an infinite universe. Thank you very much.